Well, kia ora, tato, everybody, welcome and good evening. It's good to see you here. I'm Joe Hollander, the chair of the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group and also the Engineer Charitable Trust. And we co-host these events with the Palmerston North City Library. And thanks to the heritage team at the City Library for keeping you all in touch with what's going on around the place. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome our Mayor, His Worship Grant Smith, to say a few words. Grant.
Kia ora tātou and welcome everybody. Look, thank you Joe, and good to be back here, and thanks to Joe and to members of the City Library Heritage Team, especially Jenny Feller, and obviously the Defence Heritage Advisory Group for the opportunity. And special thanks to Lieutenant Colonel Peter Wood, who's the Director of the New Zealand Wars Studies Centre at the New Zealand Defence College. And he's going to share his knowledge and insight with us this evening around New Zealanders in the Greek campaign. Now, a little over 71 years ago, this campaign in vain to stop Germany from invading Greece in early 1941 was the first to see the New Zealand Division in action during World War II. Frankly, didn't go well, and I can't help but to think there is some sort of eerie echoes of Gallipoli in these opening battles of World War II. 261 New Zealanders were killed, 387 wounded, and over 1,800 were captured, and a number of them were from Palmerston North City. It was also where the 28th Māori Battalion first saw World War II action, and 10 months after leaving their training grounds from right here at the Palmerston North Showgrounds. So knowing the reputation New Zealand soldiers went on to earn as a fighting force during the later stages of the war, I'm really looking forward to learning more from Peter about these battlefield beginnings of our Kiwi troops. So look forward to it, Peter. Thank you.
Thanks, Grant. We're really delighted to have Peter with us here in Palmerston North, shared with Trentham, the other location of the Defence College. And so without further ado, please welcome Peter Wood.
Kia ora tātou. Good to see everyone. Thanks for those kind words, Worship. And it's great to see everybody here this evening. On this occasion to look at a short campaign, unlike some others in the world on at the moment. This one was short and sharp. The picture before I move on, that's our members of 25 Battalion. That's one of the three battalions that drew its manpower from this particular region. I think I'd be overstepping the mark to suggest that those two were from Palmerston North, but we certainly would have known people from Palmerston North being in the battalion. And I have paired them up with the German infantry there, though. I think hopefully throughout the talk you'll realise that it's not just about the infantry, although it was really much an infantryman's war, but engineers, artillery, aircraft from time to time, all sorts of organisations played their part. As Mayor Grant pointed out, there is a little bit of deja vu with this campaign, because just like in the First World War, we and the Australians put our hands up, mobilised, put a division on ships. We sent them off to Europe, but along the way they disembarked in Egypt, set up camp while they waited to go further west and north to Europe. And then in both cases, a gentleman by the name of Winston Churchill came up with a better plan, and then the New Zealanders and the Australians and the British too were diverted to another campaign, and in both cases it didn't really end well. So this is the second one. And also, as the Mayor pointed out, it was New Zealand's first time in action in the Second World War, and certainly for the Māori Battalion too, who played a prominent role. So I'm going to go through that sort of thing, open up with the background to the campaign, talk about what the sides were trying to achieve. Focus really on just three of the battles. There were a lot, but I'll focus on the New Zealand ones, and particularly Thermopylae, not only because of the famous battle there in 480 BC, but it's also where the 25th Battalion, with Palmerston North people on board, played a prominent role. and then we'll go through the withdrawal and evacuation and make some observations. You'll see the map of Crete down there. I'm not going to cover that part of the campaign. Aaron already did that last year very well, so I'm certainly not going to try and repeat his performance there. So I'll cut it off pretty much, but I will make a few closing comments around Crete. So thinking back to 1940, there's Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler apparently enjoying themselves, but they probably weren't smiling like that when Benito Mussolini unleashed his surprise to Hitler, which was to actually launch an attack on Greece through Albania. He'd already made overtures into Libya as well, but he was sick and tired of being upstaged by Adolf Hitler and decided to launch something of his own so that Hitler could perhaps read about it in the newspaper. And so there was from Albania, and you'll see the green lines there outlining the lines of operational movement that the Italian army took. Infantry, aircraft and support, mountainous terrain. But quite quickly, the Greeks recovered and actually pushed the Italians back quite a long way into the Albanian territory, so it didn't go well at all. And moreover, the British got involved, and I'm not going to talk about Taranto, but these old aircraft were launched and they managed to sink quite a lot of Italian ships. It didn't knock the Italian fleet out of the war entirely. They were still a threat, but they weren't that big a threat at the time that the New Zealand, Australian, British troops were sailing across to Greece, but they did afterwards recover a bit and are still able to be a bit of a threat in the Mediterranean. And so this picture is from the Life magazine, and right towards the end of 1940, they're sort of postulating around what might happen next year based on the picture that they saw towards the end of 1940. So you'll see, in terms of German thrusts, there's the possibility of something out of Spain into take Gibraltar and really choke off the Mediterranean. There's the possibility of a drive down and towards Greece, or possibly towards Turkey, Istanbul. They certainly didn't think, although Hitler would have known at the time, you know, he obviously had designs on Russia. And for the Allies, they assumed the retention of Crete and possibly using that as an advanced base for striking at Italy and into the Italian supply lines between Italy and Libya. So that's what they thought. What about the New Zealanders? Well, the 2nd New Zealand Expeditionary Force formed up much as it had for the First World War, with Freyberg in charge this time, and again we deployed in three echelons, three waves, if you like, on ships. Although the second echelon with 5 Brigade and the Maori Battalion did actually continue on to the United Kingdom, and they were there available along with some Australian troops should the United Kingdom become invaded, which it wasn't. But nevertheless, most of the division arrived in Egypt and set up camp there at Māori, and that became the base for the New Zealanders and the Australians. And a point of note as it relates to the 5th Brigade or the 2nd Echelon, they only got back to Egypt the day before they then got back on ship and went off to Greece. So pretty rapid turnaround at the time for them. Britain had been giving assurances to Greece, and that's not something in this day and age we are unaware of ourselves, giving reassurances to nations under threat. They did some active work, so there's some bombing of Italian, Albanian ports that the Italians are using. You know, aircraft, the Hurricane, in this case, the Blenheim bomber was involved. And just for you, Joe, the first New Zealand organisation to enter combat was actually, accidentally, or possibly not accidentally if you're an engineer, a section of the Railway Survey Company, which happened to be an engineering unit. And that created a bit of consternation amongst the New Zealand Expeditionary Force headquarters and back in New Zealand, because all of a sudden New Zealanders were involved in a campaign for which the government of the day didn't have any knowledge. But there's also this unusual situation where in the early stages the Greeks actually didn't want too big a force, because they felt that if such a force landed in Greece, it might actually induce the Germans to attack. So you had this kind of awkward situation of trying to balance the force out and not trigger an attack from Germany. So what were the Germans doing? They had put a lot of forces into Romania, and really, I guess, Hitler was stacking them up, ready to push further east. But then, given Benito Mussolini's actions down in Albania, suddenly German forces started pushing down into Bulgaria and coming closer to the Greek border. And as a result, the risk to Greece was sort of was perceived more and more by the not by, only by the Greeks themselves, but the Allies as well. So you'll note also the Yugoslav border here. There's no border defences across that, so there's two separate theatres that the Greeks are potentially looking at, and the German forces massing from the north and pushing down into Bulgaria there. This gentleman here, Wilhelm Lisp, is the commander of the 12th Army, and the Time magazine had that to say about him. You know, a cunning man, picked for the Balkans assignment around mountains, which he knows, and he's taken part in the Polish and the Western campaign, so he's a very experienced combat commander of not just armoured but infantry, parachute and other forces. So he is probably just the man for this kind of operation if it should come off, and that's on the 24th of March, which is only really a short time, something like 2 weeks before the invasion actually takes place. So he made it the cover of the Time magazine. What were the German forces? Well, I'm not going to go through all in detail. Suffice to say that the main thrust, certainly towards the New Zealanders, was the Mountain Corps. And it was very a mixed organisation by way of its makeup. So it wasn't just mountain troops or just armour or just infantry. It was actually a mixture of all of those. What that meant was that the commanders on the ground had a choice of a whole lot of modes of transport, be it by foot, over the mountains, by motorcycle in panzers. And moreover, the panzer division had taken out their heavy tanks, so they only went with the mediums and the lights so that it wouldn't cut up the roads quite so much. And also they would perhaps be a bit more mobile, so they sacrificed firepower, extra range and protection for the limited breakup of the roads. The Mountain Division, they were used to walking over the hills, and even their artillery was portable so that they could carry their own mortars and artillery and machine guns when they went, which was really, really helpful. And the infantry, much of it was on motorcycles, like you see in that picture there. And the bottom picture, it actually reminded me of the New Zealand Mounted Rifles on horseback going through the hills in the Middle East, but it's actually mountain troops marching into Greece in 1941. They were well supported by the Luftwaffe, although weather did play a part, and so perhaps the German Air Force didn't play such a big part in events after all, but nevertheless, when they needed them, and if the air, the weather situation allowed it, then they could be quite decisive. So both sides deployed aircraft. So here we have the fighters, the Hurricanes at Larissa, and that's quite north, and so fairly early on the campaign they actually had to leave because they were just being able to be bombed on the ground, and so they had to withdraw further back and out of Greece. And likewise, you could, I mean, there's no Air Force people could ever envisage just being on a grass strip like that and doing an engine change and overhaul. That's a pretty primitive situation there. Germans are well endowed with heavy bombers. Not sure if that's a mission, a combat mission, or just a photo op. But very early on in the campaign, they bombed the Piraeus Harbour, hit an ammunition ship, massive explosion, destroyed a lot of the wharves, so they certainly made use of the bombers. And the Stuka dive bomber was a great one. It had been pretty successful in blitzkrieg type operations in Poland and France with its terrifying screams that came on down. Vulnerable, but nevertheless quite effective when it could. But I think the New Zealand artillery learned to just cease firing, and then of course the crews of the dive bombers couldn't locate them, so they didn't get off. They got off quite lonely from that point of view. The New Zealanders, the force was called Luster Force, or W Force, and the W came from the commander, Lieutenant General Wilson's surname probably. Nevertheless, Jumbo Wilson, as he was known, and you can see him there with General Blamey on your left and General Freiburg on the right. He's going to be the force commander. The Greeks asked for 10 divisions. The Allies assessed the need for 9. They were going to send 7, but what you kind of ended up with was just the 6th Australian Division, Lesser Brigade, so only 2/3 of it, the New Zealand Division, an armed brigade, and a couple of regiments of British medium artillery. And they were allocated some Greek divisions. And then the 7th and division and the Polish brigade, which struck off the Orbit because essentially the Germans had arrived in North Africa, so Rommel had arrived and the threat was suddenly rising, and they felt that they couldn't send more troops and armoured vehicles and all the rest of it to Greece facing this threat in North Africa. So sometimes you see how campaigns can be limited simply when you've got to prioritise things to something else that's going on that you hadn't anticipated. So the Germans had about 20 mixed divisions. They were combat experienced, and they were working on interior lines, so they would just be able to feed stuff down through Bulgaria and the like, whereas the Allies had a sea gap to North Africa. And also huge overmatched aircraft, something like 800 to 80. So that's a big deal. So the photograph, the bottom one is an interesting one. That's they're members of the 28th Māori Battalion headquarters. So they're in the back rank, fourth from the left, is Private Narimu, later 2nd Lieutenant, being commissioned, killed in action in North Africa, and then awarded posthumously VC. And on the right-hand side of the same row, up the back corner there, is one Lieutenant Bennett, who becomes a Lieutenant Colonel. So he's gone up Captain Major to Lieutenant Colonel. He's the commanding officer of the Māori Battalion, and at age 25, is the youngest in the division, so quite spectacular there. And other names in the group that I picked out, there's a Sergeant Manawatu, and there's also a Private Wikarifi, and we've got a Wikarifi, but I'm not sure if it's the same person, perhaps promoted after the photo and all the rest of it, but there seems to be some links there to the region. So the Greek forces and their plans, the Greeks are fully engaged and very pleased with the way that they dealt with the Italian threat down in Albania, and they're not really of a mind to move those troops back up to reinforce the Metaxas line facing off to Bulgaria. And that Metaxas line, and you can see some stuff there, that's their version of the Maginot line. And so they've moved up a lot of troops to occupy that, but not as many as they ought to, because also they're leaving a lot down at the bottom. But there's this kind of gap. Now the Metaxas line ends, then you've got Yugoslavia, and then you've got Albania down here. So there's quite a broad gap in the frontage there, facing off towards Yugoslavia. So the Allies decide that they're actually going to deploy. And the key thing when you're looking at this one, you'll see off to the top right the Metaxas line, where the Greeks are, and then the Albanian front where the other ones are, and then there's that gap where Yugoslavia is. But the Allied line is quite forward where that other photograph was taken, up by Katerini, and it heads, that's the Aliakmon line where they've started to dig in, prepare their obstacles, dig the trenches, sight the anti-tank guns, do all that kind of preparation. But they think, oh, Yugoslavia may be a problem there, and there will be if the Yugoslavs don't at least stay neutral, because behind them, coming from Prilep down to Monastir, there's a road that actually crosses behind the Aliakmon line and actually leads down to Rissa, to Larissa, and ends to Athens. So there's that they embark. There's a very short time between Freiburg telling the commanders that they're going to go somewhere, not even necessarily where, but they're going somewhere, and then they start boarding troops. And there's very quickly on arrival in country, they're deploying forward to the Aliac online, and the last group is not really arriving until pretty late on in the piece, about a week before the actual invasion, before the last of the troops arrive. And given that you've got to get them off ship, deploy them forward often by train and those narrow routes, it's quite some effort to get troops forward to the Aliac online. And there we are, New Zealanders, being greeted by the people of Athens as we make our way through the capital heading north. But then we've got this complication by Yugoslavia. No one's really been sure which way, and within Yugoslavia different groups of people are either pro-Axis or not, but there is a coup, and this young fellow here is actually was the regent. He is now, after the coup, becomes the king, sides with the allies. That infuriates Hitler, who immediately allocates a further 10 divisions, and moreover, the attack is going to come also through Yugoslavia. And that really puts the New Zealand and the Australian and British positions in peril, because now there's this possibility of being cut off. He's furious because he's been taken by surprise by this coup taking place. So he alters the plans. So Operation Marita suddenly includes a whole new aspect to it. So whereas before it would have been a straight drive through the Metaxas line, Salonika, and heading down, now they've got the possibility of coming through the Monastir Gap, which they do, and getting behind the Allies. So what this does is this causes the Allies to quickly withdraw back to what we now know as the Olympus line. And so therefore all that time spent digging all that barbed wire they laid out, all the mines that the engineers laid, Joe, all that stuff's basically wasted, and they have to go back, not very far, but they have to get back sufficiently so they're not going to get cut off through Germans making their way through Monastir. So in discussing then the battles, I'm just going to focus on the battles for the two choke points of Larissa and Thermopylae. So if I go back, there's a button I've been told not to push if someone gets an electric shock, so that's the wrong one here. Okay, so what I'm going to do is take the major choke points being Larissa and Thermopylae, and we're going to look at the battles on the right-hand flank of Platamon and the Peneus Gorge, and then we'll talk about Thermopylae briefly. Just go back to that. There's your choke points. And the reason that Larissa is such a choke point is the entire force has got to go through one town. And then the next choke point is Thermopylae. And we know roughly what happened there in 480 BC. But so we're just going to have a look at Platamon. And on the map it's called Tempe, but that's also the Peneus Gorge. And then we'll drop back to have a look at Thermopylae. So just those battles here. Putting a word in for my patron, the engineers. So they were very active in not so much as to wreck Greece, but to, they call it mobility and counter-mobility. On the mobility side, they had to make sure that bridges remained open, roads remained open, vehicles that broke down got pushed off, cleared obstacles so that the forces could start to withdraw or manoeuvre. And at the same time, they had to destroy bridges, block railway tunnels, do all that sort of stuff so that the Germans couldn't follow up. So they had a very busy time. And it wasn't all, a lot of it is quite makeshift sort of work, if that's the way to do it, cratering. Just blowing a hole in the roadway between an embankment and the sea, putting in a booby trap. Some of it would be quite simple but effective, and that would slow the Germans down because of the steepness of the terrain, and then that would allow the forces behind to move back if that's what they were going to do, but it would slow the build-up of the German combat power. So the first of these attacks, so the whole New Zealand division and all the Australians are to the west of Mount Olympus. But there's this tiny road, track really, leading down from Katerini, following the sea off to the right of the map. And then there's a railway line, and you can see the coast at the top right there. And there's a ridge line, where I've shown the blue line on the map. 21 Battalion, Aucklanders, city types, all on their own and put off to the side, and they're assured by General Freyberg that the Germans might come down this way, but if they do, it'll just be a small infantry security element. But lo and behold, led by the motorcycles, comes a whole half of the 2nd Armoured Panzer Division. So you've got motorcycles, tanks, artillery, the whole box and dice is coming down on an infantry battalion of 4 rifle companies, only 4 artillery, they didn't even get a whole battery, no any tank guns, and all their transport's been taken away. So they have a small engineer detachment with them who blow the tunnel so that you can't drive through it, who put mines on the wee track that goes up over the saddle, and then pretty much they're left to it. The artillery troop commander is one Lieutenant L.G. Williams. His son is Colonel Lindsay Williams, who some in the audience might remember, who was the commander of 3 Brigade in probably the 70s, 80s. And the grandson is Major General Evan Williams, who's the commander of the New Zealand, or no, is the commander of the multinational force and observers of the Sinai at the moment. So you've got 3 lines of that family who we know about, involved in different campaigns over the years. So they were astride that kind of ridge, trying to hold off the Germans. And in fact, that ridge, that's exactly what you see even today. And it was a great position. They've got 3 companies off to the right-hand side and another little company up the hill at a place called Pandalamon. And they're out there trying to hold off half a Panzer Division. They did a pretty good job. They managed to do it for nearly 3 days. And that was really essential because that stopped the Germans arriving at Larissa and cutting off the whole rest of the Luster Force before it could pass through and escape. So the Germans make their big thrust down the coast there, using the railway line on the track, and heading straight down towards the tunnel. But it's really not until they start pushing around to the left on the 16th that in fact they're about to bypass the 21 Battalion, and then the battalion withdraws
in some disorder, and they then leave behind their mortars, so they've got none of those, their wireless, their telephone cable, all that stuff. And so slowly, as the forces make their way rearwards, they're starting to lose a lot of their gear and equipment and then their fighting capacity. But really, given that these guys were on their own, shelled heavily, attacked at least 3 times, including by tanks who actually got right up onto the position but not into it, and all the rest of it, they really did an excellent job. Although sadly, they were bagged later, because in the 2nd encounter they were in, they didn't actually do quite so well at the Pnaeus Gorge. But nevertheless, from the 14th to the 16th of April, they held off a force. And that force was actually led by Herman Bolk, right? A very experienced 1st and 2nd World War commander, been in France and Poland, and later rises to be a general of panzer troops, you know, on the Russian front and elsewhere. And he was probably the best technical commander on the ground, and they held him off, or held off half of his division. But while all this was taking place, just to lift you right off the battlefield, So essentially, they're having second thoughts about the presence. On the one hand, they only want to be there if the Greeks are going to allow it, but then they're already saying, well, okay, we cannot remain in Greece against the wish of the Greek commander-in-chief. And so even at this point in time, a withdrawal is being contemplated and a move back to Thermopylae. If only the soldiers had known this. And certainly the commander of 21 Battalion didn't know it. He mistook radio silence for turn your wireless off. So he never received the information about the movements back towards Thermopylae and all the rest of it either. So there was a little bit of confusion there. But
Yeah, so they had made up their mind, and I think the fact that they knew then that they were going to retire, actually the withdrawal of the ANZAC forces was actually quite well done, given the numbers of people, the numbers of vehicles, and the limited routes available. The actual movement back was quite well done. So the next battle for good old 21 Battalion is this one called the Panias Gorge or Tempe. That's a picture of it there. It looks pretty much like that today. And so they've left Platamon, come back, they've crossed this Panias River, and engineers put in a cratering demolition so that the tanks and the infantry can't cross the river. And on one side of the gorge, there's a road on the southern side that the Germans will eventually come along, and on the northern side there's a railway line. And it sounds very much like, oops, there's the German approach, the Manawatu Gorge. So I saw this photo the other day, thought about this talk and said, this is it. So Woodville's over here, the Germans are coming from Woodville, and the New Zealanders are down pretty much towards Ashurst. So what's happened is the railway line, you can just see a little bit of it on the right-hand side of the river, that's been blocked by the engineers. They've blown up some railway carriages inside a tunnel, so the tanks and that can't get any further forward. So essentially the Germans have got to transfer onto the other side of the river, and then using that goat track through the gorge, they've got to get to the other end. And believe me, the hills are as high as those ones there. So when 21 Battalion puts some infantry down on the top of the hill, they can't even see into the gorge, let alone do anything. Artillery shells can't actually lob themselves into the valley, so it's very difficult terrain there. And you know, I couldn't get an aerial shot of the Panias Gorge, so this will have to do. But So just going back to that, the Germans approach on the railway side, they can only get as far as the tunnel, so the tanks are stopped there. But what they do is they start to wade the river. And that's unobserved by the battalion because they haven't put patrols forward to watch it. And they lose a couple of tanks in the process, but essentially they manage to swim a few across, or they won't really swim, they sort of wade them across. And once they get there, the crater has been abandoned by the New Zealanders, so the Germans quickly able to fill that in. And then they make their way slowly but surely. They only need three tanks now because the New Zealanders, because the gorge is so narrow, have put themselves in very small penny packeted groups. So when two or three tanks turn up, there's actually nothing you can do with your rifle and your Bren gun. And so they're quite quickly rolled over. And the CO makes a fatal mistake, or a tactical error. His decision is that instead of falling back and then withdrawing his battalion back towards the Australians in 16 Brigade down at Ashurst, instead what he's going to do is going to head to the hills. And so as they withdraw, each of these platoons and companies starts heading towards the southeast. And then long after the Greek campaign is completed and they are slowly making their way by boats and whatever else to Crete on fishing boats and things like that. But the other thing that really throws the Aucklanders out is they can see coming down off Mount Olympus, the mountain troops are coming down over the hill. They can actually see lines of troops coming down the mountain, and then they start putting in attacks behind them. And so I think their morale has been rather shattered by it all. And so rather than fight their way out with the Australians, they, like some of the other Australian troops, head for the hills and are no longer formed units able to take part in the campaign. But for all that, and this is the action that we 21 Battalion got a bit of a bad reputation, between those two actions they did manage to hold the Germans out of Larissa, which then allowed the rest of the Luster force to actually get back through Larissa to the Thermopylae line. And so Thermopylae, more famous for the Spartans and all that sort of business there. Today, it's a lot wider now because of the seabed and coastal shift and all that sort of thing. But in the midst of all of that is our 25 Battalion, with definitely with members from the Manawatu, Palmerston North area in it. It's a bit of a messy black and white map, but nevertheless, the Germans are starting to swing around. So the same little snick that the Xerxes team used to outflank Leonidas and co, that's now called the Brelos Pass. And so the Germans have put a pretty big thrust down to try and get through the Brelos Pass to come in behind the New Zealanders, who are now holding out at Thermopylae. But what they do decide to do, I'll bring a slightly bigger picture. This is the forward battalion. It's made up of the 25 battalion with Charlie Alpha Bravo Delta companies in a very narrow part of the road. Swamp and then sea to the front, hills to the south. So the tanks are basically going to drive straight at the New Zealanders, who have to stay in position. But what they've got around them and behind them is masses of anti-tank and field artillery. And so pretty much the field guns are firing in direct action mode, which means none of this indirect stuff. They're just firing direct on at tanks, and they're pretty good tank killers, and that becomes a huge tank killing ground. There's so much carnage of the tanks that the tank commander decides to hold off and do the whole thing again the next morning. What he doesn't know is that night the New Zealanders all thin out and they disappear and they make it back to the evacuation points. So there's another action, admittedly by a different battalion to 21 battalion, and I can't cover all the others, what 28 battalion did, what 22, 20, all the rest of it. I've just picked out three. I'm not trying to promote 21 battalion. I'm just highlighting three particular key battles during the campaign fought by the New Zealanders. But this is one battle that really highlights the significance of artillery in both its forms, field artillery but also anti-tank artillery. So the Germans, well, perhaps not that guy on the right, but everybody else made it into Athens by the 27th of April. This is the Hotel de la Grande Bretagne, the Great Britain Hotel. That actually was also, and it still stands today, but that was the British headquarters. So, yeah, we'll have our parade in front of your old headquarters team and send you the photograph. And this one, of course, with the Acropolis in the background. Not quite sure what the guy with the pistol up the background was doing. Maybe have fun or you'll get it. But, yeah, they got their mileage out of it in terms of the public relations. But I think, too, the guy there, I'm not sure if he's just a motorcycle infantryman or whether he's a courier or something like that. But I think, irrespective of whether you are Axis soldier or allied, you would have been exhausted physically and mentally by the end of this campaign. This is non-stop, you know, for the Allies in particular, the threat of just being cut off and left behind, knowing that your convoy doesn't leave until 2 o'clock in the morning and everyone else is leaving at 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, all the psychological pressures and all the rest of it. People say that the only aircraft we ever saw were the German ones, so there was all this kind of stuff going on along the way. Quite a tough campaign, and this is even before the days of night vision goggles and making it really 24/7. So then there's a withdrawal. Basically, most of it, the ships come forward and take many of the Allied troops to Crete. Some go all the way back to North Africa, but a lot of them are dumped on Crete, so that quite quickly the ships can return and take more. But the point I'd make there is that when they left, trucks, field guns, anti-tank guns, heavy machine guns, a lot of equipment was left behind. So those troops that actually got to Crete, and they looked pretty happy with themselves, didn't really have much stuff at all. And they were going to need it, although only they didn't know it at that time, that how badly they were going to need it. The Germans also mounted a paratroop and glider assault to try and capture the Corinth. There's a canal through there. They wanted to capture the bridge so they could get into the Peloponnese but also cut off the Allies. They captured it intact, but a stray anti-aircraft shell struck the bridge and blew it up, killed a lot of Germans. But by that afternoon, the Germans had rebuilt the bridge, and so it was all on again. But nevertheless, 50,000 Allies were able to get away despite all of that.
That's the one we built during World War One.
Yeah, yeah.
New Zealand engineers built that during World War One.
Yeah, we're lost to a stray anti-aircraft shell. So what was the bill, if you like? So the strengths, you can see the British still had the major numbers involved. The Palestinians and Cypriots didn't have any particular units, or they weren't there as nations, I think, especially the way they're grouped. They were probably supply, support, transportation, that sort of support to the British. And it also accounts probably for their low numbers of killed and wounded, but their quite large numbers of being kept, taken prisoner. Australia, a lot of casualties, you know, similar sort of strengths, similar numbers of killed and wounded, and lots of prisoners. So if you look at the New Zealand losses, so nearly 300 dead is at least half an infantry battalion's worth, just dead. 600 is a good battalion's worth of that. You know, maybe 25% won't ever return to duty, another 25% will, but in restricted capacity. But those prisoners, they're gone. So that's 2.5, nearly 3 battalions taken prisoner. And so all the reserves that had come forward and were waiting in North Africa were quickly taken into there. And we got to a point when El Alamein was being fought that there were, in fact, no reserves to come forward. And so infantry companies normally of 100 to 120 soldiers maybe had 70. Rifle sections of 10 maybe had 4 or 5 only in it. So a lot of it can be attributed to the heavy losses sustained by not only killed and wounded, but by people taken prisoner. And they, incidentally, had the longest tour of all. So other than some of the commanders like Freyberg, you know, if you're in that first, second, third echelon, you're probably away at war for about 3 years. But if you were taken prisoner in Greece or on Crete, you did about 6 years away before you got home, into your home. The German losses, quite heavy. That's what they advised, nearly 1,200 killed and nearly 4,000 wounded. And often the attacking force, because they're out in the open and above ground, will have some pretty substantial losses. And then Crete, which is the one I'm not going to talk about, really it's just to make the point that a lot of these campaigns are connected, and just like things kicking off in North Africa prevented some of the other divisions and armour coming forward into Greece itself, the way that the Allies got back to Crete without all their gear meant that they weren't very well disposed. You know, they didn't have all the capability that they normally have with all the weapons and equipment that had been left behind. But as I said, Crete was covered last year by Aaron, and I think his presentation would be online still. Certainly you do see that this is a classic example of being drawn into a campaign. You know, and even into specific operations. And so now in the military, we would talk about a national red card where the senior national officer, and indeed the senior national officer reporting back to New Zealand about a particular operation or task the commanders want the New Zealanders to perform, you know, you're apt to raise a red flag to say, no, we're actually not going to do it. Or they want us to do this, we come back to Wellington and get advice on whether to do so or not. And it also brought out about the piece around, you know, around the commanders on the ground providing information back to New Zealand. So afterwards, Freyberg admitted that he'd had reservations about the whole Greek campaign, but he hadn't expressed those back to the Prime Minister and that beforehand. So after that, he obviously did, and that has carried on to the today, where we're expected, the senior national officer is expected, even on a small contingent of 10 or 4, to report back to New Zealand to make sure that we're not being misemployed or put at too much risk over and beyond what they would normally accept for the operation. You get politics versus reason. So they knew the Greek forces were weak. They knew that the Allied force wasn't going to be all that effective. And they knew that the Greek roads and ports weren't there, but they still decided that they would deploy. And even then, the Australians and the New Zealand governments agreed that the deployment would go ahead. Then you've got the host nation considerations. the whole business of the will to fight. Will they actually fight? Do they want to fight? Some Greeks did and others not. And where? So the Greeks wanted to remain in Albania and on the Metaxas line, but really, and you can't, and they, even though they agreed to move some, they actually didn't. So you can't actually control what the host nation or the other allies do in some of these campaigns. And then the command and control, not just the language, but the ability, who's actually in charge, and will elements of one nation follow the orders of another? Not necessarily so. Even though they may say they might not. And you have to think about that and factor that in to the planning. And the other thing, as much as the engineers did a lot of demolitions, a lot of considerations to making sure that the Germans just didn't bomb Greece simply by, if the Allies had defended every little town, Larissa, every little thing, fought on the streets in Athens, they'd have trashed it. And the Greeks didn't want that. And I don't think the Allies wanted that either, so they were, it was better that they actually withdrew rather than fight tooth and nail to hold on there. What we also found was that the New Zealanders, and probably the Australians too, since the First World War, had really lost touch with the way that warfare was going. And so quite quickly, tactics, weaponry, they hadn't seen proper anti-tank guns. Mackie was arguing with the Australian where to sight them, forward, back. They didn't know how to use them. They'd never seen tanks in action. They didn't know, you know, what sort of terrain. So today you try and keep up with the sort of warfare that the opposition is might employ. The Germans had a lot of flexibility. They grouped mountain troops and all the rest of it. The Allies aren't quite so good at that. We tend to stick to infantry and or armour. The infantry-armour cooperation for a while was not so good. One of the other things that came out of the campaign was one of the brigade commanders was a guy called Puttick. When he came back to New Zealand and became the commander back here, he was very quick to establish that staff college that we talked about a couple of months ago, because he realised that the New Zealand officers hadn't been trained in operations and staff work, and whilst they might be okay running a platoon or a company or an engineer troop, they didn't know how to coordinate all the actions within a brigade or divisional setting. So it also led to the formation of the staff college. I guess I'll probably later the point a bit about the impact that a campaign can have on another campaign, by the way, you know, things unfold. And I guess it was a short campaign, but it wasn't necessarily a blitzkrieg in the true sense of the word. I mean, I don't think the dive bombing and then the thrust by the Panzers getting into the rear of the positions and creating all that mayhem, the sort of stuff that went on in Poland and France, never really unfolded in Greece. And I think that's partly attributable to the terrain and partly attributable to the way that the Allies were able to sort of hold them off through the limited passes that were available to the Germans. So, yeah, a bit of a select bibliography there, but more than happy to take questions or anything like that. So thank you all for your attention.
So, questions. Very interesting. Yep.
Really cold, for a start, freezing cold. Good visibility at some times for, say, aircraft observation, or like you saw the photograph there, some quite long range, but at times drizzle, rain. I mean, it was, the weather there would normally be pretty kind, but it was extremely cold there, and it did impact on flying operations from time to time.
Yes.
Even though the Italians started it all, did they have much impact on the actual fighting in Greece?
Not really, no. But then once the Greeks had decided, you know, it was all the Germans. Pretty much. I think they made some limited things just towards the end, more for show. And they were then granted rights in terms of occupation as well by the Germans, because that would also relieve them of the necessity to be the occupying troops, but they didn't play a significant part of the campaign, not the combat.
an incident of trains. Two New Zealanders who got two old engines going and assembled some carriages and took quite a few.
The New Zealanders actually had railway companies. They had railway engineers who surveyed and rebuilt them. But a lot of New Zealand railway drivers and workers actually ran and operated, certainly in North Africa, trains. And then the trains themselves were the primary mode to deploy 21 Battalion, Māori Battalion. Most of the troops actually went north on trains.
I think the interesting thing was that most of those railway engineers were either in the UK or they were back in Egypt. And it just so happened that 19 Survey were under the command of the Middle Eastern forces, mm-hmm. British, not the New Zealanders. And that's why Freyberg didn't know that he actually had New Zealand engineers in Greece doing surveys. In fact, the New Zealanders and Australians were all over the world, if you like, doing surveys of a lot of the railway infrastructure, so that they fed the information back for the staff to do their planning. But in fact, the one that you're talking about, I recall the tale about that one, where within those infantry battalions, you had guys who were mechanics and boilermakers and fitters and welders and so on. And that particular tale was when they were trying to pull out a couple of fitters and welders in one of the battalions, actually resurrected some old Greek steam boiler trains, engines. So that the troops could actually escape using the Greek railway. And, I mean, there were plenty of examples of that all the way through. There was a lot of good old Kiwi ingenuity and number 8, wire sort of activity, because they really didn't have a lot of supplies or a lot of the logistic support that you would normally go into an operation. I mean, that's another thing about the Greek campaign. It was a baptism by fire because it was the first time the New Zealanders had been in conflict. And in some respects, for those that managed to get out back to North Africa, it was probably a good thing that they'd actually been through that, because they'd observed a lot of what the Germans did and what they had, and were able to use a lot of that to good effect. Crete was a bit of a disaster, but yeah. But yeah, that's that tale. Yeah, Steve.
Peter, I'd have to thank whoever made the decision for the 27th Machine Gun Battalion to go back to North Africa after the Greek campaign. Because my father was in that and didn't go to Crete and came back to North Africa. How was that decision made? What was
part of it's luck of the draw of the ships that you were on and where you were sent to, where you were taken back. But in the actual campaign itself, the 27th Machine Gun Battalion tend to be broken up and allocated out to the different battalions. Sadly, not to 21 Battalion, but that's how they operated. But I think they must have formed back as a unit at an embarkation, and then the particular one they went to, they just ended up back in North Africa. Luck of the draw.
And in fact, there were quite a few that managed to get back to Alexandria but didn't go to Crete, and I guess they thank them, their lucky stars. Yeah. Brian?
Acknowledged as a standard alone campaign, but that's, I mean, in medals, anyone that served there with a particular medal for the Greek service, or were they given the African service or anything like that?
No, I think the Mediterranean theatre, of which Crete, Greece and North Africa form part, and that included maritime service, fighter pilots and bomber pilots who were on Malta and elsewhere, Kiwis. It was the North Africa campaign.
North Africa Canada. Star.
North Africa Star.
Was the medallic recognition. There was nothing for Greece or Crete as separate campaigns. Yeah. Other questions? Comments? No? Everybody wants to go home for dinner. So, look, without further ado, can you please join me in thanking Peter once again.